On the panel today are the award-winning beer writer Neil Miller and Steve McCabe, the physics teacher, beekeeper and pilot. Good afternoon, Neil. Good afternoon, Steve.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Now, what have you both been up to? Let's start with, I don't know if it's the more exciting news of the two, but Neil, you are off on a big trip.
Yeah, so on Friday I got an email promising a very special invitation, and like many New Zealanders, I've been fooled by emails that offered special invitations or special deals before. But this one was actually an offer to go and visit probably one of the most famous breweries in the world, the Pilsner Urquell Brewery in the town of Pilsen in the Czech Republic, probably the first brewer of Pilsner beer. And the chance to go over there and have a look around this historic and quite beautiful brewery is very, very exciting.
So, were you chosen at random?
I think I was chosen on merit, I'd like to think. They take a few people every year, so I've read about people that have done this trip, you know, sort of my beer writing heroes, and to be able to go and do it myself is exciting. It'll be my first time ever in continental Europe.
Really? Are they going to pay for it?
Yep. So, yeah, so it's very, very exciting. So I must say that I was doing a little dance around the house on Friday afternoon when I should have been working.
I bet you were. So we're going to hear about this trip that you make to the Czech Republic for the next 6 months.
Yeah, try shutting me up about it. Yeah, I will be talking and writing about it quite a lot because it's very, very exciting.
We'll all keep the envy out of our voices as we say, well done, and I hope you have a marvellous time.
Thank you.
I'm so in the wrong job.
Yes, you are. But you have been able to fly helicopters.
Well, I didn't actually drive it myself, but I'm going to have to now. Yeah, I, like you mentioned in my little talk at the beginning there, I've been flying fixed-wing planes for about 10 years now, and I've never been up in a helicopter until about 2 weeks ago. I was working on a magazine article about learning to fly in New Zealand for an American flying magazine, and they wanted photography. So I contacted one of the helicopter operations up at Ardmore Airport, and they took me up for about half an hour out over the Hauraki Gulf and out over Waiheke Island. And it was a phenomenal experience. I've never seen anything like it. You know, in an aeroplane, you sit at the end of the runway and you put the throttle in and you build up your speed and eventually you just climb up off. Helicopter, you just sit there and suddenly the ground goes away. And it's a wonderful, wonderful experience. So we were about 700 feet up with nothing, not even a door, between me and the waters of the Hauraki Gulf. They took the door off specially so I could do photography. And it was a wonderful experience. And I'm now going to have to learn to fly helicopters.
Have you thought of featuring helicopter trips around the world, like in the Czech Republic, for example?
I could be Neil's helicopter chauffeur. We could fly from brewery to brewery across Europe.
Isn't it funny? It's funny to hear a pilot talking with such ingenuousness about a trip up. It sounded like someone who'd never been in a plane before.
Well, that's exactly how it felt. I mean, you know, I've been flying fixed-wing planes for years. I'm blasé. You know, I'll just go and fly a plane. It's what I do. Just stick me in a helicopter, and suddenly I was grinning like a little kid. It was fantastic. And we got down, I was talking to the pilot, and I said, I'm going to have to learn to fly these. And he smiled, and he says, you fixed-wing pilots, you all secretly want to fly them, don't you? Yeah, we do. In case any listeners are interested, by the way, Robinson R44. Somebody will phone in and ask.
Right, that was the type of helicopter.
Yes. So somebody will care.
Steve McCabe, Neil Miller, a lot to talk about. And first, the Labour Party's to have an independent review of what went wrong in the election. People haven't been short of ideas, of course, for this sort of review in the last few days, as we know. But we don't know the ins and outs, do we, behind the scenes? Actually, Rob Salmond, who I know you know, Neil.
Yes, absolutely. He conducted the last independent review, and this year he was an advisor to David Cunliffe during the debates.
I know. There's an interesting piece on his Polity blog about how he trained David, because he kind of falls on a sword. He trained David Cunliffe for the debates. He did voter targeting. He managed the direct mail program. And it's a nicely written piece by him about the defeat. And of course there were others. Matt McCartan had the strategy, and Moira Coatsworth, Tim Barnett raised the money, one presumes, and oversaw candidate selection. So there would be various ins and outs, but do you think an independent review is needed? Because the Nation reviewed, of course, the party found it wanting in the end. What do you think?
Oh, I think it's absolutely the right thing to do. I mean, I have a certain degree of empathy for Rob and you know, Labour ministers, MPs and staff and defeated candidates, because when I worked for the National Party, it was during sort of the worst time for them. So when I started work for them, National was on 43%, and when I left, it was on 22%, and it's gone up steadily since I left. So it is hard when you get down into the kind of doldrums, and you feel that you've spent ages working on a policy, you've come up with a great idea, and you put it out, and nothing happens, and then a candidate in an unwinnable seat says something dumb, and that's on the news, and you just can't get momentum, and it's so hard to get get out of there. And sometimes you just need a circuit breaker, like an independent review coming in and saying, you know, with no prejudice, no sort of loyalty to any of the existing incumbents, this is what you need to do to change. Things aren't okay. You know, if you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to get the same result again. You have to do something different. And that's hard often in any organization to accept being told that.
To quote back at David Cunliffe, his prediction the day before the election, there is a momentum for change. I can feel it. It's palpable. That is now his problem, isn't it? The desire for change within the Labour Party.
Oh, I think absolutely. I think, you know, you saw some of the most awkward political television of that 7 hour sort of Labour caucus meeting. You know, you saw David Cunliffe saying no one's going to talk to the media, and then having to walk past his colleagues giving sort of media stand-ups in the corridor outside the caucus room. So there's a real tension, and yeah, it's difficult. I mean, it must be such a difficult environment to operate in, and he's got a certain dignity about the way he's dealing with it, to be honest.
All right, before Dr. Bryce Edwards joins us, your thoughts, Steve?
Well, good. A couple of thoughts come to mind. I mean, first of all, I don't know that David Cunliffe takes the entire responsibility for this. I do think that Kim.com and Nikki Hager take a decent amount of responsibility for deflecting attention away from anything except the National Party. And as a result, you know, it is as we all know, there's only one thing worse than being talked about. That's not being talked about. National were the focus of everything. Everyone was talking about John Key. Everyone was talking about what the National Party may not have done. No one was talking about what Labour or the Greens or anybody else wanted to do in the event that they were elected. Policy got pushed out the window, and everyone was focused on the personality of John Key, which is another thing that I think is worth mentioning in regard to this. We do have very, very strongly personality-driven politics here all of a sudden. It's becoming presidential. I noticed when Matt Nippert was on Friday afternoon, right before the election, he was talking in terms of if Cunliffe beats Key and if Craig gets in, and it depends on how well Peters does, everything was about personalities. And basically, David Cunliffe didn't quite have the personality to pull it off. It doesn't matter what the policies are.
Dr. Bryce Edwards joins us, the political scientist from Otago University. Good afternoon, Bryce.
Good afternoon, Jim.
And thanks for your comments on the Saturday night. They were nicely erudite. Out of interest, back in January, I dug this up today, you published some grand political predictions. Way back. Oh, no, it's just interesting. And the Fairfax Parliamentary Gallery crew did best. They gave National a third term, various MPs losing their seats. Colin Craig wouldn't make the 5%. Bryce, the only what they may have got wrong, and your comment on this, is this prediction: David Cunliffe will stay on as Labour leader. How safe is that prediction now, in your view?
Oh, not very safe, because there's this huge appetite for change. If he can put himself at the head of that reform and convince people that he's part of the change, he might survive. But at this stage, I think the appetite is just so huge to have radical reform within Labour that he's likely to go.
Of course, Helen Clark was beleaguered once, wasn't she? You know, Michael Cullen and a whole lot of people went along and asked her to go, and she didn't, and eventually she came the triumph. And will that be on David Cunliffe's mind?
No, I think the parallels are just not there. They seem to be totally different circumstances. This is three elections in a row that Labour appears to have gone downhill, you know, and people are feeling we haven't learnt the lessons, and we actually need quite a big shift. And so the best parallel I think you can draw is with National in 2002, when under Bill English they only got 21%, and that led to huge change in National, and it essentially made them much stronger. So although it might sound, you know, counterintuitive, I think by losing so badly on Saturday, Labour's put itself in the best position to actually have real significant reform of itself.
This would have sounded like a really wild question a wee while ago, but is there even the possibility of a schism? You know, because David Cunliffe apparently has the broad support of the unionists and the wider party, so we're always told.
We're always told that. I'll just have to quickly mention that I do wonder whether the union movement and the wider party activist base will think a wee bit differently about Cunliffe now that he's had his turn and failed. And in some ways, he's not really seen as taking the party to the left in the way that some of his left-wing supporters had hoped. So I wouldn't presume those factors have Cunliffe as their main option anymore.
And I think if Andrew Little remains outside of Parliament, so there's a chance he can get in on the specials, but if he remains outside of Parliament, I think the unions will take another look and say, this is a guy that we put a lot of investment and time into, who we think is our representative in caucus, and he didn't get in this time. They might rethink some of their support for Cunliffe and go back to someone who might deliver more MPs.
Is there the possibility, because you sounded half interested when I first mentioned it, Bryce, of a unionists party with someone like David Cunliffe or Andrew Little in charge and a more centrist party? I mean, is this actually being contemplated in certain quarters?
Well, I wasn't really prepared for answering this, but I will mention that I think eventually we're going to see, and I don't know if this is 2 years' time or 20 years' time, eventually we're going to see a traditional Labour Party that's very focused on union issues, jobs, economic growth, etc., to the left, and it'll be a major party, and then more towards the centre will be the Green Party that's more focused on social liberal issues, and that's where there's a lot of crossover between Labour and the Greens at the moment. They need to divide out that a bit more distinctly, and I think the Greens will be a better place to be on the right of Labour.
David Parker's ended the speculation today that he'll contest the leadership. It's interesting, isn't it, how free they are starting to feel, especially David Shearer, to talk, Bryce.
There is huge tensions below the surface. They're just people are not wanting to move too fast and to, break ranks. But throughout the party, there's a lot of angst, and no one wants to be the person that is seen to be splitting the party. But there will be a lot of quite bold talk, I think, soon, and a lot of candidates will be declaring their hands in the next week or so.
All right, so turbulent times ahead short term, and maybe nasty times too, but it'll all be forgotten. Our political memories are short, aren't they, by the time the next election rolls around?
Yeah, things do move very fast. And again, to come back to that 2002 parallel, when National did so poorly, they had a huge fundamental rethink, and they had this independent review that was led by Stephen Joyce. At that stage, Stephen Joyce wasn't really active. I don't even think he was a member of the National Party, but he was.
No, he wasn't.
To do the independent review, and there was huge change. And it wasn't just about looking at how National had campaigned in that election. It was about the whole branch structure, the headquarters of the party, and how the party, all the nuts and bolts worked. And we saw quite a dramatic change. I think this is what we're going to see this time around. But we also saw National almost double their vote in the following election. Under Don Brash, they went from 21% to, 46 or 47%. So, yes, 3 years can be a short period of time.
Workplaces have changed, though, since the heyday of the unions, haven't they? And employment law has supplanted some of what they perennially used to agitate for. Does the Labour Party have that kind of broad enough base of support now that it can engender that kind of change and make it stick?
Maybe not so much in terms of the unions, because, yes, they only actually have 20% of employees belonging to them these days. But in terms of, still the vast majority of the country works and has jobs and are concerned about issues like employment and the cost of living. And I think there's a concern within Labour to move back towards that sort of issues rather than the social liberal ones of people's identity, their gender, sexuality, their ethnicity. So there's this idea of having a more broader church focused on the core traditional Labour issues of economics, basically.
Bryce Edwards, thank you. Dr. Bryce Edwards joining us on the panel. 21 minutes past four. You're a fairly veteran political watcher, Neil Miller. What do you think's going to happen?
Yeah, it is difficult times. I mean, I found Bryce's suggestion that the Greens will move to the right of Labour to be quite intriguing. I mean, I have a lot of friends who are in that sort of left-wing space, and they are sitting there sort of saying, what's the best thing I can do for the left-wing movement? Should I give up my Greens membership and join Labour? Should I give up my Labour membership and join Greens? Can I do both? And so there's going to be, I think, a long period of angst. And I think there's going to be a lot of settling down. I think the Greens will be disappointed at their result. They always get a result slightly less than their polling, but this was a lot less than I think they were polling. And I think the idea that Kim.com stole a lot of oxygen from Labour and the Greens is correct. So I am anticipating quite a messy fight for the Labour leadership. I'm not sure who will come out of it. To go back to the national example in 2002, to get that huge increase in the vote, not only was there the independent review, but there was a change of leader and there was a change of president. And there was a change of head office staff as well. So it sometimes needs quite a big change. So, yeah.
All right. Any closing thoughts from you?
Yeah, just thinking, I do get a sense of seeing some of this kind of stuff happening before. You know, Britain in the 80s, we had a very, very unpopular Conservative government, and the election was Labour's to win, and they blew it because they simply weren't united. The same thing happened in reverse in the 90s. Labour were ready to collapse, but the Tories simply couldn't fight against them. Same thing in the US in the 2000s, 2004 election. There's no reason in the world that George Bush should have been re-elected, except that the Democrats couldn't put up a viable opposing candidate. And I think that the left of centre in this country is in serious danger of doing exactly the same thing yet again with a disunited front. If you're going to have disarray within the Labour Party, and then you've got the Green Party realigning itself to effectively steal votes away from Labour, and then you've got a very monolithic and well-structured National Party on the other side, then National are going to take it every single time.
United we stand, divided we fall.
Yeah, that'll do.
John Key has asked for his officials to come up with new ideas to tackle child poverty. And he seemed sincere about this, didn't he? He said it late on election night and obviously conscious of all the pre-election criticism. But do we need more reports on this?
I'm just thinking, you know, somebody should get my dictionary and show me the word irony.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, there is massive child poverty in New Zealand, and John Key's been Prime Minister for the last 6 years. Does he take no responsibility for it?
What would you do? I mean, we have had endless discussions on poverty and a lot of experts interviewed over the years. On Monday, we went to it again and there was some level of agreement among panel members with Professor Jacqueline Roweth on board doubting the level of true poverty in New Zealand. Some level of disagreement about that from listeners subsequently. But isn't this part of the problem, the definition, and the mistrust of the definition of, you know, a mean poverty line that some people fall below and some people fall above? Neil, what are your thoughts, first of all, on poverty and what you would do?
Yeah, I think there's a legitimate debate around some of the measures where, you know, by definition, a certain number of people, a certain percentage of people will always be defined as being in poverty. And whether that's absolute poverty or relative poverty, that's up for debate. I think it's unfair to say that John Key's not sincere about doing something about child poverty. I think a lot of his economic policies have been designed to get families into work and get them in a better economic situation. I think here...
I said he seemed sincere.
Because
he raised it off the bat himself late on Saturday night.
Oh, no, what I'm saying is that I've seen suggestions from other people, not you, Jim, obviously, other people, that it's not sincere, that it's just sort of, you know, it's a focus group result. But I think what he's trying to do is say, this is a priority. And when the Prime Minister, I mean, he's got limited times, limited resources, there's only so many issues he can personally focus on, and he's saying this is going to be one of them. Officials, you get to work, you know, first thing on Monday. And so I think he's trying to indicate there's a greater urgency and a greater priority. I think it probably does need to start with a report, but the proof will be what actually comes out of it and whether it makes a difference.
All right. On the same subject, families are too poor now to pay for NCEA. The cost of NCEA fees, and Steve, this will be one for you, is forcing hundreds of Waikato families to apply for financial assistance. Throughout New Zealand, more than 23,000 fee payers have been granted help so far. That's a lot of people. Hamilton Budgeting Services say they can't keep up with demand from families finding it hard to make ends meet. 45% of Fairfield College students sitting NCEA exams had applied for help with costs, 45%. At Melville High School, more than a third. And yet the most a family with a number of children will be asked to pay is $200. For most candidates, the price is $76.70 a year. So that is a sign of hard times for many out there. And do you see this in your school?
I actually tried, when I saw what we were talking about today, I tried getting actual statistics on how many kids at my school, which is a low decile South Auckland school, how many kids were actually getting the reduced $20 or the $15 rate as opposed to the $78 standard rate. And as I was asking around, the comment that kept coming back to me was, well, what are they paying for anyway? Where does this money go? What value are students receiving from it? And the money's being paid to NZQA. And increasingly, NZQA are doing precious little in return for it. At my school, for example, many of the students I teach aren't doing a single external exam this year. I'm doing NZQA's job for them. And yet NZQA are charging significant sums of money to these kids. We want to know what do they do for the money?
Well, NZQA says costs for them include exam setting, printing, sorting, holding, marking, moderation.
Right, and as I say, increasingly, NZQA are devolving the workload back onto teachers. Within my specialist area of physics, I've seen level 2 and level 3 topic standards in particular have been taken out of the external examination process, which covers the points you just raised, the marking, the printing, the preparation of exam scripts, and they've been converted into internally assessed topics, which means that all the work that NZQA used to do, I now do. And yet, NZQA are not getting paid any less for doing that, and I'm certainly not getting paid any more.
Okay, so you're saying the cost could come down.
I would like to know where the money's going first, yes.
NZQA are, I think, legally obliged to work on a cost recovery basis. And so, for example, I do some work in the tertiary sector, and NZQA staff's time is charged out to tertiary institutions at $150 an hour. So, you know, at $78, which seems a lot, is roughly equivalent to half an hour's time from one of their analysts. I think it's good that there is the relief that, that people can apply for it. I think the issue is that not enough people know that that option is out there. And there is an issue about who's actually doing the work as the qualification system continues to evolve. And there are similar issues in the tertiary sector as well.
Well, there's a couple of remarks to be made to that. First of all, if they are working on a cost recovery basis and their workload is being diminished by virtue of the fact that it's being shunted onto teachers, then how is the fee structure staying the same, unless they're saying that they're suddenly having other costs to meet?
My understanding is that that's a 33% cost recovery for this particular charge, which would probably be the lowest of anything that they do.
Okay, fair enough. And then with regard to publicising the lower rate, which is available to students who qualify for other forms of financial aid, it's extremely delicate to bring it up in schools. Mm. We do stand in front of our classes and say, okay, everyone, you need to make sure you get your fees paid, but don't forget, if for some reason your family is going to be struggling to pay $78, you can get a form that might enable you to pay $20. What you can't do is say, you, little Johnny, we know you're poor, right? You should be paying the $20. It's an extremely delicate conversation to have, and it becomes very, very awkward singling kids out and saying, look, we know you're probably going to struggle. So all we can do is present the information, and we do.
All right. Steve McCabe, thank you. Agreed. Neil Miller on the panel. Back with them shortly, but at 4:30 with the news headlines. Hewitt Humphrey.